We'll begin with my commentary for today. Today's show is September 16th. We'll begin with my commentary. In case anyone wants to defend Barack Obama's performance so far, BBC News recently announced that he would not lift the economic sanctions against Cuba. The stated reason was that he wanted Cuba to become more democratic before he would lift sanctions. I'm left wondering if Obama's ever heard of a country called China. We do lots and lots of trade with China, and last time I checked, no one has accused China of being in the slightest bit democratic. The double standard is alive and well in D.C. Next item. I've commented on this before, but it remains one of the greatest absurdities in the wonderful American system of non-governance. I refer to the quaint custom of tacking on to any bill before Congress a multitude of non-related amendments. Senator Baucus's dead whale of a health care non-reform bill presently has over 500 non-related amendments tacked onto it. With such a system, it's a wonder any legislation gets passed, except for the truly onerous bills, such as the Patriot Act, which no congressperson had the guts to hinder by tacking on absurd amendments. Common sense would dictate that every bill or amendment must be able to stand on its own and be voted on its merits alone, rather than snuck into other legislation. The fact that it must be snuck into other legislation is proof positive that it fails on its own merits. But I apply standards of efficiency and common sense to the machinations of D.C. How foolish of me. You want more absurdities from Obama? He gave another of his wonderful speeches, this time to the UN, beseeching its members to take more responsibility for the world's problems, and specifically to stop producing nuclear weapons. This from the nation with enough nuclear weapons stockpiled to blow up the world a gazillion times over. North Korea has proven that if a third world nation wants to have any power on the world stage, having a nuclear potential is the easiest and quickest option. Nasty truth, but there it is. Earth to Obama. The world is much more concerned with economic meltdown than nuclear meltdown. And to date, you've still done nothing to rein in the rapacious capitalists in your own country who caused the problem and continue in their greedy ways. In fact, by appointing them to monitor themselves, you are enabling them. Okay, related item. For the rest of this show, I'm going to focus on two subjects: the swine flu scare and the possibility of government-forced vaccinations, and if I get time, housing foreclosures. I again postulate that these issues are, or should be, far more important than Obama's preaching about nuclear disarmament. So one must wonder if his focus on a non-solvable, yet highly emotional issue, is but a smokescreen while the government prepares to vaccinate us with something. All for our own good, of course. Am I spreading needless paranoia? I don't know. I read. You decide. The first article is from PrisonPlanet.com. Joseph Moshe, a Mossad microbiologist. Swine flu vaccine is a bioweapon. Today, mainstream media are not talking about this case anymore. Yesterday, they wanted us to believe that Joseph Moshe was a nutcase and a terrorist, arrested for threatening to bomb the White House. Interesting detail about his arrest was that he seemed to be immune to the 5 cans of tear gas and 5 gallons of law enforcement-grade pepper spray they pumped into his face. He very calmly remained in his car, as the video footage of his arrest shows. Professor Moshe has called into a live radio show by Dr. A. True Ott, broadcast on Republic Broadcasting, claiming to be a microbiologist who wanted to supply evidence to a state's attorney regarding tainted H1N1 swine flu vaccines being produced by Baxter Biopharma Solutions. He said that Baxter's Ukrainian lab was in fact producing a bioweapon disguised as a vaccine. He claimed that the vaccine contained an adjuvant, an additive, designed to weaken the immune system and replicate the RNA from the virus responsible for the 1918 pandemic Spanish flu, which caused global sickness and mass death. Sources tell us that Bar Joseph Moshe made no threat against the president of the White House. He did not mention any bomb or attack. He then proceeded to inform the White House he intended to go public with the above information. When he noticed men in suits in front of his house and feared that the FBI was about to detain him, he packed some belongings into his car and, him being a dual Israeli citizen, tried to reach the Israeli consulate located in close proximity to the federal building where the standoff took place. The FBI and the bomb squad prevented him from reaching it. So who is this man? His profile on biomedexperts.com says he's a plant disease expert with many publications on his name involving the genetic manipulation of viri. Photographic evidence that Moshe is who he says he is can be found here, and then they give you a link. Joseph Moshe was soon after his arrest sent or let go to Israel. Nothing's been heard from him since. The Secret Service was not the agency involved in the surveillance of Moshe at his home in California. This was done by the FBI, who had orders to detain or arrest him. Mounted on top of a large black vehicle used in his arrest was a microwave weapon that possibly damaged the electronics in Moshe's car, as well as any communication devices he had which might have been used to contact the media or others who could have helped him. Moshe did not suffer the same effects of the gas and pepper spray that others would have, because he's built up an immunity to such weapons as a byproduct of his Mossad training. Moshe was not handcuffed because he was not placed under arrest. Does this sound like an insane conspiracy theory? Sure it does. Due to the scarcity and anonymity of the sources, we would dismiss it as exactly that if it weren't for some uncomfortable facts. Baxter Pharmaceutical has been caught red-handed in spreading a live, genetically engineered H5N1 bird flu vaccine as a lethal biological weapon all over the world, destined to be used for human vaccinations. This happened just a few months ago, and only luck prevented a global catastrophe of epic proportions. Baxter International Incorporated had mixed live, genetically engineered avian flu viruses in vaccine material shipped to 18 countries. Only by sheer luck, a Czech laboratory decided to test the vaccine on a dozen ferrets, which all died within days. The World Health Organization was notified, and catastrophe was averted. This was clearly a deliberate act on Baxter's part, because they adhere to BS3 Biosafety Level 3. Baxter admitted a, quote, mistake. Such monumental screw-ups are totally impossible at that level. Many safety systems would have needed to be sabotaged. Many key personnel would have needed to be bribed. It simply can't be done without direction from the inside. They did not send out the wrong vial. They produced dozens of gallons of biological weapons agent, genetically engineered live H5N1 bird flu virus. And they then sent that out as a, quote, vaccine. Baxter knew full well that their vaccine was lethal because the year before they tested it on a few hundred homeless Polish people. Dozens died as a result. Where's the meat? Well, Baxter is now being sued for the deliberate, repeated contamination of vaccines with biological weapons designed by them to mass murder people. Here's the complaint, and then they give a PDF file. Is this by some kook nutcase? Not likely. Jane Burgermeister is an experienced, respected journalist. She's not the only one suing Baxter for planning and executing a plan for global genocide. Others are filing complaints as well. Motive? The later complaint alludes to it. Have you heard of the Georgia Guidestones? An enormous monument loaded with Masonic symbolism costing millions of dollars. It's been erected by unknown, powerful elites, multimillionaires with a clout to erect monuments wherever they please, obviously. It was erected around 30 years ago. It gives an alternative Ten Commandments, of which the first is the extermination of 6.5 billion people from the face of the earth. 500 million will remain. This is the number of people the planet can sustain indefinitely, so that the descendants of the Rothschilds and Rockefellers can live in peace and affluence indefinitely. Slaves are needed to produce that luxury, but 500 million will do just fine. But how does one go about killing off most of the world? Quote, vaccinating the planet with a bioweapon with near 100% mortality would do the trick. Baxter would provide both the bioweapons as well as the vaccine against it to civilized Western peoples. Result, we can plunder Africa, we have no more competition from Southeast Asia, the oil is ours for the taking, and only Western and perhaps Chinese sheep will remain. Rockefeller said this in 1994 at a UN dinner, quote, we're on the verge of a global transformation. All we need is the right major crises, and the nations will accept the new world order, close quote. PNAC said something similar right before 9/11 when they talked about a new Pearl Harbor. Okay, that was from PrisonPlanet.com. This is by Paul Joseph Watson from the Health Freedom Alliance, and it's published in Infowars.com. And I don't want anyone to wet their pants that this one seemed worthy of reporting. You have to decide how factual it might be, and if so, what you can do about it. It's titled Police and Military Train to Intern Swine Flu Vaccine Refuseniks. According to whistleblowers, law enforcement and military personnel are training to set up checkpoints in order to catch people who refuse to take the swine flu vaccination, while health authorities are laying the groundwork for a mass vaccination campaign by warning that serious and potentially deadly health problems will be blamed on the H1N1 vaccine. In a YouTube video, a woman describing herself as a soldier explains how she was part of a drill in California centered around setting up roadblocks and checkpoints so authorities could check who has received the swine flu vaccine. Those who have had the shots will be fitted with an RFID bracelet so they can be tracked. Those who have not taken the shot will be offered it there and then, and if they still refuse, will be carted off to an internment camp, according to this woman. This individual needs to go public with her full name and position because she'll already be known to authorities just by being on the YouTube. By remaining anonymous to the public only, her testimony can be dismissed as just someone ranting on YouTube. However, her statements about tracking people who have taken the vaccine via RFID bracelets is something that's already been beta tested by health authorities. Former Kansas State Trooper Greg Evanson underscored this claim back in July, making the following comment on it at an event in Texas. Quote, "Have you been made aware of the massive roadblock plans to stop all travelers for a vaccine bracelet, stainless steel band with a microchip on board, that will force you to take the shot?" Evanston wrote on July 29th, "Refuse it, you'll be placed on a prison bus and taken to a quarantine camp. What will you do when your children are not allowed into school without the shot? What will you do when you're not allowed into the workplace without the vaccine paperwork? Buy groceries? Go to the bank? Shop anywhere? Get on a plane, bus, or train? Use the toilet in a mall? Nope. Police officers will become loathed, feared, despised, and remembered for their official duties." Authorities in Boston have already trialed such technology with the purpose of creating a vaccination map, charting which people have taken the vaccine and which have not, or creating a citywide registry of everyone who has had a flu vaccination. This was described in a Boston Globe article. Participants were given a bracelet with a unique identifier code exactly as described in that YouTube clip. Quote, "Infectious disease specialists in Boston and elsewhere predicted that the registry approach could prove even more useful if something more sinister strikes, a bioterrorism attack, or the long-feared arrival of a global flu epidemic. In such cases, in such crises, the registry could be used to track who received a special vaccine or antidote to a deadly germ," according to the article. "Anything you can do to better pinpoint who's vaccinated and who's not, that's absolutely vital." This was spoken by Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. "I wish more cities were doing the same kind of thing." While governments have publicly backed away from talk of mandatory mass vaccination programs, their actions, behind closed doors, indicate that they're preparing for a state of medical martial law. An international swine flu conference held recently in Washington, D.C., and attended by the world's top health authorities, featured workshops on enforced quarantines, mass vaccinations, and how to, quote, "control and diffuse social unrest and public disorder," close quote. Individuals who attempted to gain access to the conference representing the media were turned away by officials at the conference. As we reported earlier this month, a shocking internal document outlines the French government's plan to impose a mass swine flu vaccination program on the entire population, which would be focused around regional vaccination centers and would be carried out by H1N1 injection teams, completely bypassing medical establishments and general practitioners. Legislation has already been passed in the U.S. that would allow state vaccine teams to go door-to-door to conduct immunization interventions and look for people who have not taken the shot. It is unclear how authorities plan to enforce any such mandatory vaccination campaign, especially in light of anecdotal evidence suggesting that a large majority of the public will refuse to take the shots. Polls taken in the United Kingdom indicate that a majority of nurses and other health workers, the primary targets of the first round of vaccinations, will refuse to be vaccinated. It is likely that threats, intimidation, and removal of rights and conveniences will force most holdouts to take the shot. Once governments start imposing quarantines and travel bans on people for not taking the shot, a sizable number are likely to acquiesce. Since the dangerous ingredients that will be included in the H1N1 shots became known to the public, opposition to proposed mass vaccination programs has snowballed. As we've previously documented, the swine flu vaccine was rushed through safety procedures while government have provided pharmaceutical companies with blanket immunity from lawsuits arriving out of the vaccine causing deaths and injuries. It was previously revealed that some batches of the vaccine will contain mercury, a toxin linked to autism and neurological disorders. The vaccine will also contain the dangerous ingredient squalene, which has been directly linked with cases of Gulf War syndrome and a host of other debilitating diseases. It was also recently reported that the United Kingdom government sent a confidential letter to senior neurologists telling them to be on alert for cases of a brain disorder called Guillain-Barré syndrome, or GBS, which could be triggered by the vaccine. The CDC in America replicated this warning weeks later. As a result of the dangers of the vaccine becoming widely known, authorities are moving to get out ahead of the story by acknowledging that millions of health problems in the aftermath of a vaccination campaign will be blamed on the vaccine. And they cite the 1976 swine flu debacle when the shot proved far deadlier than the actual virus. Reuters reports that public health officials, quote, expect an avalanche of so-called adverse event reports, which are reports of death, illness, or other health trauma that occur within 2 weeks after receiving treatment, in this case, the swine flu vaccine. We're going to be overwhelmed with potential events, this is again spoken by Mike Osterholm. By coming out early and claiming that these problems would have occurred without the swine flu vaccine anyway, authorities are creating plausible deniability for when side effects from the shot begin to appear. A number of factors now indicate that authorities in both America and Europe are not only preparing mass vaccination programs, but are also training law enforcement and military assets on how to deal with those who refuse to take the shot. Given the fact that around 150 million Americans own guns, and some would be prepared to use them to defend their families against police and troops forcibly jabbing needles into them, it seems unlikely that health authorities in the U.S. will go down this route. However, by implementing travel bans, school bans, and other forms of general quarantine, a good number of those refuseniks may eventually be intimidated into taking the dangerous shot. But a good number of them will stand firm, and that's probably where the internment camps and martial law will come into play. Only by diffusing the rampant hype behind the relatively harmless swine flu virus and reaffirming our right to reject enforced medical procedures conducted against our will under the Nuremberg Code will the swine flu hoax, which is being used by governments as a smokescreen to accelerate and implement the police state, be defeated. That was from Infowars.com. And subsequent to this, I received an email from a listener, and it gave a whole series of links for anybody that wishes to research this further, and that will be up on my website. He says with the links, the original poster of the video was a very brave young woman. She's a 37-year-old Army engineer, and over the weekend of September 12th to 13th in the Los Angeles area, she attended a drill with colleagues, including California Highway Patrol, LA County Sheriffs, and LAPD. One of these colleagues told her that he'd recently been training to establish roadblocks in the L.A. area. She references the testimony of former state trooper Greg Everson. There's a link to that. And shows clearly readable documentation and a photo taken by her colleague of what she states is an RFID tracking device. And a link to that. It's a little unclear what information she's learned at first hand and what she's learned from others whom she trusts. She states that she knows that the dates for the two waves of forced vaccinations are October 15th and November 15th. It's not stated how she knows this. However, the information reported seems credible, and if true, could not be more important. So for somebody that wants to further research it, those links will be on my website. And if you need them sooner, then email me, chamba@kvmr.org. Okay, more of the same. All right, let's break for a second. The time is 12:29 in the p.m. The place is Nevada City, California. The radio station is KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. And your host is Chamba Lane. And the name of the show is Rabble Rousing. All right, we're going to read one more on swine flu, and then we're going to switch focus. Will Americans obey government orders during a swine flu pandemic? Survey seeks to discover if citizens will trust authorities enough to take the H1N1 shot. This is by Paul Joseph Watson, PrisonPlanet.com. Local authorities are keen to know whether American citizens will obey the government in the event of an H1N1 pandemic and take the swine flu vaccine amidst growing fears of quarantines and forced injections that have been circulating in recent weeks. Every sign points to the fact that health authorities are preparing mass vaccination programs and quarantines that could be instituted should the H1N1 virus make a deadlier comeback, which has all but been guaranteed by U.S. health authorities as well as the World Health Organization. Part of these preparations include gauging the potential reaction of Americans to unpopular orders dictated by an increasingly distrusted government. How many citizens will follow orders to stay indoors, evacuate, or take a shot? Some of those questions form part of a survey being conducted by the University of Virginia's Health Department, targeting everyone except, quote, federal government agencies and their employees, close quote, who are not qualified respondents for the survey target population. And this was according to an advisory sent with the survey. The survey was forwarded to us by a reader who's part of a CEO-only networking group called Mindshare from the Washington, D.C. area. I was sent the survey below, and it's probing folks in Virginia, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. and what they would do in a pandemic or anthrax situation, writes Etienne de la Beauté. They appear to be trying to determine if folks will comply with government directives in either a flu pandemic or anthrax attack. The survey, entitled Community Shielding Shared Spectrum, was issued by the Critical Incident Analysis Group of the University of Virginia. The CIAG lists its role as understanding how critical incidents have the potential for creating social trauma and undermining social trust in government. This was according to its website, and comprises of a network of experts from academia, media, government, military, law enforcement, industry, and the behavioral sciences. It doesn't mention where the pharmaceutical industry is involved. The survey contains a raft of questions about disaster preparedness and attempts to clarify whether people will trust the government enough to follow orders and accept vaccines during a pandemic or biological attack. Some of the survey questions are listed as follows. For an anthrax attack that occurred during the workday, local authorities are liable to require people to shelter in places where they are. For many, this would be at work or school. Assuming that there was adequate food, water, and medications and sanitary supplies, how long would you be able to stay before family or personal circumstances would force you to leave? The multiple choice answers range from, I would not stay at all beyond normal working hours, to more than 14 days. The follow-up questions ask how long people would stay in their homes if ordered to do so by the government. If a vaccine for swine flu is offered this year and consists of a series of two shots in addition to the normal seasonal flu vaccine for a total of three shots, will you? The choices range from not taking any shot to taking both shots for swine flu and the seasonal flu shot. The next question asks, if the individual would take medication delivered to them by authorities in the event of an anthrax attack or a swine flu pandemic, it does not state whether such medication would be delivered at gunpoint, as many currently fear. If you live in an affected area and are instructed by government officials to evacuate, would you? The respondent is then given two choices, stay at home or comply with the instructions and evacuate. The next question asks their reason for not obeying the orders to evacuate. From question 46 onward, respondents are grilled about which authorities they trust in relation to a pandemic or biological attack. Law enforcement, the CDC, which is Center for Disease Control, and State District Transportation Department are all listed. Respondents are then asked how confident they are in the federal government to respond to a disaster. Question 53 asks, has the recent outbreak of swine flu, H1N1, made you more or less likely to follow guidance from the government or from public health agencies regarding health issues? Question 54 onwards ask which source of information are deemed most trustworthy by the respondent and which of these would be followed during a swine flu outbreak. Federal government websites, mainstream media outlets, religious organizations, and other non-governmental websites, social networking websites, or blogs, all are listed. A plethora of questions about race, education, employment, household issues, and other detailed queries accompanied the questions highlighted, and the survey runs to no less than 81 questions in all. This survey is clearly part of a national effort on behalf of authorities to gauge how Americans will react to being ordered around by a federal government that citizens are increasingly suspicious of in light of increasing awareness about the dangers of the swine flu vaccine and an understanding of what happened during the government's last attempt to enforce Mack's vaccination program for swine flu during the 1976 debacle when the vaccine killed more people than the actual virus. Unfortunately, for the people tasked with carrying out any such forced vaccination program, 150 million American gun owners are not going to respond nicely to people who want to inject their children with mercury, squalene, and other deadly additives that are admitted to be contained in the H1N1 shot now being rolled out. For their sake, and for the sake of preventing anarchy and widespread violence, we need health authorities to come out publicly and state clearly and vehemently that no such mandatory vaccination effort will take place. Until that happens, fears about what the government is planning behind closed doors in relation to swine flu will only persist and become stronger. That was Paul Joseph Watson writing in PrisonPlanet.com. Okay, we're going to take a brief musical interlude because Steve Baker on his Monday morning show played a song which I loved. So here goes. Okay, here almost goes.
You are hearing voices from NPR, the best of public radio. This is part one of a tribute to radio raconteur Gene Shepherd, producer KCRW in the year 2000 by another radio and TV great.
I'm Harry Shearer.
Okay, that was not it. We'll try again.
So by the way, be sure to bring your gun and buddy, we're number 37. We're the USA. We're number 37. And we're so proud to say, we got old people crying at the pharmacy, paying deductible. This ain't the land of the free grandma. We're number 37. And we're the USA. People of the town, fold your hands and pray, because we are a Christian nation, and that is the Christian way. I'd rather win number 37. We in the USA, the big number 37. And we're so proud to say, we're number one in tanks, we're number one in planes, we're number one in war, with number two for brains.
Yeah, we're in the USA. All right.
Well, there you have it.
Oh, yes. Hello?
All right. While that was on, we had a listener call in, and he has some information, which I think you'll find interesting, on the issue we were discussing previously. Please go ahead.
All right. Am I on?
You're on. You're live.
Okay. I work at a major medical center in the Bay Area. I won't tell you where it is.
Fine.
And I work with neonates and pediatric patients. One of the things, we've already had several H1N1 cases.
Okay.
They've affected pregnant women. All of these women have become seriously ill, meaning life support, long-term life support, damage to their lungs, blah, 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 blah. However, the children, it doesn't appear to cross the placental barrier. The children all get put in total isolation, but they all end up testing negative. Now, having been exposed to the moms and having been exposed to the babies also, we use what we call universal precautions, which are gown, glove, mask, the whole thing. That seems to work. I mean, I've been doing this for 3 months.
You have not contacted the swine flu.
I have not contacted the swine flu.
Okay.
Right. Now, I also took the swine flu shot back in that debacle. It made me sicker than a dog.
That was back in 76?
Yes.
Okay.
And that was the last flu shot I took.
Okay.
And the opportunities they give me as a healthcare professional, and they're already trying the media blitz, saying, you know, you guys are on the front line, so you need to take the shot. You either have to take the shot or you have to sign a declination form.
Okay.
All right. Now, this is my
conjecture.
Well, it's a conjecture, but this flu seems to strike either those with compromised immune systems or those with hyperactive intact immune systems. That means young adults who mount an immune response. Or now, people don't think of pregnant women as being compromised hosts, but the fact is that one of the things that happens when a woman is pregnant is that her own immune system scales back so that she doesn't reject her fetus, because it's not her. There's you and not you.
Yeah, okay.
Okay? And so that puts them at risk. All right? So basically, the rest of us who are normal, who are either not compromised or have normal, not hyperactive immune systems, and I happen to be one with a hyperactive immune system. They've given me the...
Okay, I'm going to have to ask you to speed it up.
All right. My point is that I think that people need to not be too blown away by the media hype over the swine flu. The flu,
okay.
The regular flu kills 30,000 people. Is it 30,000 or 300,000 people? I don't know which it is.
Stop for a second. I was most interested in your conjecture that one of the reasons for them promoting this flu vaccine is because the pharmaceutical companies
have
invested
somewhere.
Wait a minute. They've invested a fortune in producing these.
That's right.
And if they don't foist it on the public and have the government pay for it, they're going to lose
a shitload of money.
Okay.
I went in, and it's the same thing as I went through the military going to Vietnam. I got 18 shots before I went to Vietnam.
Right.
You know, and okay. they were mandatory. I had no choice.
Right.
So I'm
okay.
saying it's a market.
Okay, thank you very much for your call and your educational advice.
Yeah, tell people to wash their hands and stay away from people who cough, and other than that,
relax.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
All right, bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay. Next item. I love Greg Palast. Here's his latest. He titles it, Change Bernanke's Medication, Secret White House Letters to the G20. It's Greg Palast, writing for the Huffington Post. I still get a thrill whenever I get my hands on a confidential memo with the White House, Washington, appearing on the letterhead. Even when, like the one I'm looking at now, it's about a snoozy topic. This week, the G20 summit. But the letter's content shook me awake and maybe kept me up the rest of the night. The 6-page letter from the White House, dated September 3rd, was sent to the 20 heads of state that will meet this Thursday in Pittsburgh. After some initial diplomatic blather, our President Sherpa for the summit, Michael Frauman, does a little victory dance, announcing that the recession has been defeated. Global equity markets have risen 35% since the end of March, writes Frauman. In other words, the stock market is up, so everything's fine. While acknowledging that this year's economy has gone to hell in a handbag, Obama's aide and ambassador to the G20 seems to be parroting the irrational exuberance of Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke, who declared last week that the recession is very likely over. All that was missing from Bernanke's statement was a banner, mission accomplished. And the French are furious. The White House letter to the G20 leaders was a response to a confidential diplomatic missive from the chief of the European Union, Frédéric Reinfeldt, written a day earlier to Monsieur le Président Obama. We have Reinfeldt's confidential note as well. In it, the EU president says, despite Bernanke's happy talk, the crisis is not over, and the labor market will continue to suffer the consequences of weak use of capacity and production in the coming months. This is diplomatic speak for, what the hell is Bernanke smoking? May I remind you, Monsieur le Président, that last month 216,000 Americans lost their jobs, bringing the total loss since your inauguration to about 7 million and rising. The Wall Street Journal also has a copy of the White House letter, though they haven't released it. I have, and then he gives it here, and then he also gives the EU message in his translation of it. The Journal spins the leak as the White House would want it. Big changes to global economic policy to produce lasting growth. Obama takes charge. What's missing in the Journal report is that Obama's plan subtly but significantly throttles back European demands to tighten financial industry regulation and, most important, deflects the EU's concern about fighting unemployment. Europe's leaders are scared witless that the Obama administration will prematurely turn off the fiscal and monetary stimulus. Europe demands that the U.S. continue pumping the economy under an internationally coordinated worldwide Save Our Butts program. As the EU's Reinfeldt puts it in his plea to the White House, it is essential that the heads of state and government at this summit continue to implement the economic policy measures they have adapted and not act unilaterally. Exit strategies must be implemented in a coordinated manner. Translating from the diplomatique, if you and the USA turn off fiscal and monetary stimulus now, on your own, Europe and the planet sinks, America with it. Obama's ambassador says no. Instead, he writes that each nation should be allowed to unwind and anti-recession efforts at a pace appropriate to the circumstances of each economy. In other words, Europe, you're on your own. So much for Obama channeling FDR. The technical policy conflict between the Obama and EU plans reflect a deep difference in the answer to a crucial question. Whose recession is it, anyway? To Obama and Bernanke, this is a banker's recession. And so, as, quote, stresses in financial markets have abated significantly, close quote, to use the words of the White House epistle, then happy days are here again. But if this recession is about workers the world over losing their jobs and life savings, the EU's view, then it's still, buddy, can you spare a dime? If Bernanke and Obama were truly concerned about preserving jobs, they would have required banks loaded with taxpayer bailout loot to lend those funds to consumers and businesses. China did so, ordering its banks to increase credit. And boy, did they, expanding credit by an eye-popping 30%. Rocketing China's economy out of recession and into double-digit growth. But the Obama administration has gone the opposite way. The White House letter to the G20 calls for slowly increasing bank reserves, and that can only cause a tight credit market to tighten further. It's not that the White House completely ignores job losses. The U.S. letter suggests, quote, the G20 should commit to income support for the unemployed, close quote. You can imagine the Europeans, who already have generous unemployment benefits, mostly without time limits, turning purple over that one. America's stingy unemployment compensation extension under the stimulus plan is already beginning to expire, with no live proposal to continue, and for the jobless victims of this recession. The Europeans are so cute when they're angry, and they pound their little fists. Obama assumes he can ignore them. The EU, once the big player in the G7, has seen its members' status diluted into the G20, wherein the BRIC powers, that's Brazil, Russia, India, and China, now flex their muscle. But Europeans have a thing or two to teach Americans about the economics of the twilight of empire. Maybe the differences are cultural, not economic. that Europeans lack America's manifest destiny can do optimism. So, to give the visitors a taste of yes, we can spirit, Obama should invite Pittsburgh's 93,700 jobless to the G20 summit to meet to celebrate the 35% rise in the stock market. Or, my own suggestion, change Bernanke's medication. That was Greg Pallast, and he was writing in the Huffington Post. This one's out of the San Francisco Chronicle. 30 billion dollar home loan time bomb set for 2010. The writer is Carolyn Sade, Chronicle staff writer. Thousands of Bay Area homes have a ticking time bomb embedded in their mortgage. The homes were purchased with loans known as option ARMs, short for adjustable rate mortgages. Next year, many option ARM payments will begin to readjust, slamming borrowers with dramatically higher monthly mortgage bills. Analysts say this could unleash the next big wave of foreclosures, and home loan data shows that risky loans were heavily used in the Bay Area. From 2004 to 2008, one in five people who took out a mortgage loan for both purchases and refinancing in the San Francisco metropolitan area, one in five people took all those out. That's more than twice the national average. People think optional ARMs will be a national crisis, he said. That's not really true. It's just the high-cost areas, like California, where you're going to see their prevalence. Of the 10 metropolitan areas nationwide with the most option ARMs, three are in the Bay Area. Why are so many option ARMs clustered in the Bay Area? In markets where home prices were going up rapidly, more and more borrowers needed a product like this to afford something. Option ARMs were designed for savvy real estate investors and people whose income fluctuates, such as those paid on commissions. Instead, the loans became a tool for regular people to stretch or buy homes that were beyond their means. That's because option ARMs let borrowers choose to make very low payments for the first 5 years. During that initial period, borrowers can pick their payment option. They can pay interest and principal, interest only, or a minimum monthly payment that doesn't even cover the interest. It was said that 94% of borrowers elected to make minimum payments only. The shortfall gets added to their loan balance, which is called negative amortization. The amount they owe, they can grow substantially. Well, you understand all of that. The bottom line is, when it's time to recast their loan, their equity doesn't even get anywhere near what they're expected to pay. Unlike subprime loans, which were more commonly used for entry-level homes, option ARMs started out with high balances. That means they'll spawn foreclosures amongst upper-end homes. The mid-to-high-end real estate market is already stranded right now, said a mortgage consultant. Any sort of extra inventory is not going to be welcome for that market. They became widespread starting in 2005, which is why 5 years later, in 2010, they're going to come due. And most option ARM borrowers owe much more than their homes are worth, so they can't refinance their way out of trouble. It's going to unfold over several years. There may be time to avert a deluge of foreclosures. It's possible that a solution will arise either through rising home prices, allowing them to refinance, or through extra intervention from the government or lenders to help these borrowers. This will be another factor keeping home prices from recovering, said another expert. It should be a message to policymakers in Washington that there's a big group out there that falls outside the parameters of what's being addressed by current monetary policy. My comment, going back to Obama's speech to the United Nations, which do these citizens fear more, nuclear war or the loss of their homes? Despite his eloquent words, Obama's actual response seems to be echoing Dick Cheney. So? Further comment, if the Bay Area housing market tanks, this seems quite possible, how will this affect housing market where you live? And will you be personally affected? I read, you decide. Well, no time for lengthy articles, so we'll go into this one. I have to confess that after listening to Barack Obama's brilliant oratory and then observing his continuing lack of walking his talk, I'm starting to miss George Bush. Neither actually were or is serving the American people, as both are obviously beholden to the same shadowy masters. But at least old George gave us some laughs along with our suffering. So here is to George with a sample of his bitter quotes. The vast majority of our imports come from outside the country. If we don't succeed, we run the risk of failure. Republicans understand the importance of bondage between a mother and child. No senior citizen should ever have to choose between prescription drugs and medicine. I believe we are on an irreversible trend toward more freedom and democracy, but that could change. One word sums up probably the responsibility of any governor, and that one word is to be prepared. Verbosity leads to unclear, inarticulate things. I have made good judgments in the past. I've made good judgments in the future. The future will be better tomorrow. We're going to have the best educated American people in the world. And during an educational photo op, one of the great things about books is sometimes there's some fantastic pictures. Illegitimacy is something we should talk about in terms of not having it. If we're ready for any unforeseen event that may or may not occur. It isn't pollution that's harming the environment, it's the impurities in our air and water that are doing it. And, finally, to Sam Donaldson, I stand by all the misstatements that I've made.